BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Friday, June 1st, 2012. This is podcast number 155. My name is Ben Stone. So I want to recap something from yesterday's podcast. Not a huge recap, but I just want to touch on it again. That I was talking about the Bilderberg group, and I was trying to do so in a non-foil hat way. I was trying to, if you didn't hear the podcast yesterday, I was trying to point out that it's really not necessary to sit down and come up with elaborate conspiracies in regards to the Bilderberg group, because all you have to really do is follow a logical progression of a person who believes that the state is a good vehicle for guiding society. And if you do that, then if you take that concept that a person has faith in the state, and then you add an almost unlimited amount of funding to that faith, you have a monster. So you don't really need tinfoil hat conspiracies. You don't need to imagine, you know, hoof-footed monsters trying to guide the world into a one-world government. All you need to do is think about people who have almost unlimited funding and who actually believe that human beings would be best, or human beings are best, when a powerful state has a hand upon them and making them obey, making them guiding them to prevent societal breakdown. If you have a group of people who really believe in the myth of the state, and you give them unlimited funding, and if those people are good, if they're honest, if they believe war is bad, and if they believe humans need a powerful guiding hand to hold society together, then a single worldwide state is the logical solution for the advancement of mankind. If you really believe in the state, then if you just walk that thing out to its logical conclusion, one state is better than two states, because two states can fight. Two states are better than 10 states. 10 states have more opportunities for war than two states. And 100 states have more opportunity for war than 10 states. So the logical progression here means that if you really believe that the state is the best way for mankind to survive and to thrive, then logic dictates that you narrow that down to one state. So you don't have to have foil hats, and you don't have to think about aliens, and you don't have to, you know, have all kinds of wild conspiracies. If you accept on the surface that the Bilderberg group is honest people attempting to help the world get better. Now, I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm saying that's the best case scenario. You can believe that without a foil hat, that they are honest, rich people, rich politicians and rich business people who honestly believe that they can better society. If you accept that, and you don't even have to accept that they're evil or they're monsters or anything like that, if you accept the very best case scenario, then the Bilderberg group and organizations like that can only bring destruction to mankind. Think about Selene's Law. I've talked about this a few times. This is Robert Anton Wilson's. He had three laws that he called Selene's Laws, and they're named after a character in one of his novels. Selene's Law number 3 says, an honest politician is a national calamity. And the third law seems preposterous at first, but the logic goes like this. Well, a dishonest politician is interested only in bettering his own lot through abusing the public trust. An honest politician is far more dangerous, since he is honestly interested in bettering society through political action. And that means writing and implementing more and more laws with good intentions but bad repercussions. Now, at this point, remember Bastiat. Remember what we've learned from Bastiat. It doesn't matter what the intentions of the law are. There's that which is seen and that which is unseen. And if that which is seen or if that which is intended is good, then you can almost guarantee that the end result is going to be bad. It may not be seen right away. It may not even be seen in the long term. Many of the results of so-called good laws are hidden into layers and layers and layers of government failure. So you don't necessarily see them unless you really dig down and look for the root cause of things. So, for instance, if you consider the drug wars, and you see somebody like the recent thing, the thing that the media is all going crazy over is these bath salts. Every parent has to be afraid now. We're supposed to be afraid of bath salts. Oh no, let's make those illegal. Well, why is it that somebody would? Why? What kind of crazed thoughts go through a person's mind to take bath salts and ingest them into their body? That's, you know, not knowing exactly what's going to happen, but knowing that it's going to not be good. Well, this is levels and levels and levels of idiotic laws that make other alternatives. You have a person who wants to escape reality for whatever their reason. There's a flaw in something to do with that person's life. And they seek a way to escape that. And if you've outlawed every other way for them to do this, and if you've put barriers in their way through governmental laws and all the things that the government inflicts upon us, then you drive people towards really stupid decisions like crushing up bath salts and snorting them up your nose. This is not just what you see on the surface. It's based on 100 years of a ridiculous way of thinking that progressives have pushed onto America, that somehow one group of people can use violence and aggression to make other people behave the way they want. And when you have layers and layers and layers of that nonsense, then you get to the, you know, I'm thinking of these commercials. I don't know if you've seen these commercials or not. I don't know if they're very widespread, but we have them here in Western Ohio. They're for, I believe they're for one of the satellite TV companies. And there's a series of somewhat flawed, but they make logical progressions that are not necessarily legitimate, but it makes a fun argument. And so, like one of them, the voiceover says, it shows a guy sitting in an apartment or whatever, and the voiceover says, "When you have to wait for cable TV, you get bored. When you get bored, you stare out the window. When you stare out the window, you see things you shouldn't see. When you see things you shouldn't see, you have to disappear. When you have to disappear, you fake your own death. When you fake your own death, you dye your eyebrows and show up at your own funeral. Don't dye your eyebrows and show up at your own funeral. Buy our product." And so there's this, of course, it's a ridiculous leap from one thing to the other, but that's serving the point of the commercial. So, you know, if you don't buy their product, their satellite TV or whatever, then you're going to end up faking your own death and dyeing your eyebrows. Of course, we could pick apart the logic on that. But the progression there in steps that is displayed in this series of commercials, if you take and you use, you know, actual logic and not commercial ad logic, but if you look at the things that we face in American society and throughout the world, and you start to go backwards and say, what caused this? What caused that? Why did this shift from this to that? Then you begin tracing these things backwards, and I get accused of this all the time. People say, well, you think all the problems in society are because of the state. Yes, I do. Follow them backwards. Almost every single problem that you follow backwards eventually comes to some stupid law or somebody trying to inflict their will upon someone else. So when you have people like this Bilderberg group or any other group of people who, if you accept the premise that they are sincerely trying to do good, and yet their method of attempting to do good is by using government to achieve that good, then you have guaranteed that evil will be the net result in the end. There will always be more evil produced through aggression than there can possibly be good. Okay, so that was just a recap of some of the things that I intended to say yesterday, and I couldn't because I got wrapped up in, you know, I get carried away sometimes. That's really how it goes. Now, I wanted to talk about history a little bit today, and specifically lies in history, and really what's the purpose of history. I've touched this a number of times before. If you really think about it, what we call history or what we know of history is really just propaganda. It's a form of propaganda that's used to justify the deeds of the state. It's very often, it's a series of lies that glorify a king or a hero or a particular government or a society that's very status-based. Almost always, history is a twisted version of what actually happened, and it's twisted in a way almost always to glorify one or the other players within the state. And I believe, I'm not sure, but I believe it was Napoleon that said that history is simply that which was written by the victors, if I recall. I think that was Napoleon that said that. But even, no matter who said it, and he may have been quoting someone else, but whoever said it, that's really what it is. For whatever generation that you are in, and you're looking at history, and you're looking back on the record of events that comes down to us and that we are eventually fed, what you're basically looking at is state propaganda. And it may tend to tilt towards one group or another group, but ultimately, it almost always supports the idea that the state is glorious and the state is good, and we must depend on these kings and heroes of the state to save us from the, you know, from the evil men and the evil human beings that are out there trying to constantly attack us, that only the state can protect us from these. Now, I'm thinking specifically, you know, I've been, day after day, I've been talking about this thing on the History Channel, about the Hatfields and the McCoys. And I'm not going to go into a lot of stuff on that today, and I'm not really even going to go into a bunch on Appalachia today. So if that was boring you, you'll have a little bit of an escape. But I am going to try to tilt it into the same time frame and compare the events that were going on as depicted in that show about the Hatfields and McCoys in the late 1800s. I'm going to talk a little bit today about the 1800s in the Old West and how the history that we have of that is almost entirely a lie. Almost everything that the average person thinks about the history of the American West is all based on lies. And that's really easy to show. Pretty much, if you really think about where we get, or if you just do some research and really take a look at it, where the origin of almost all of what we accept as the history of the old American West was written to initially sell dime novels, and then later in the early 1900s and all the way up into the 1950s, what we believe, what we think of as history of the old West was actually, you know, movies. It was Hollywood movies that were mostly targeted at children. From the 1930s all the way up into the 1950s, the vast majority of Western movies that were made in Hollywood were almost entirely targeted toward children. Now, those children, as the generations of them grew up, by the 1960s and the 1970s, Hollywood began producing more adult, and I don't mean pornographic, I mean adult oriented for movies that were more palatable to adults, let's put it that way. So you have the John Wayne character, and I'm not saying anything, I love the old movies, I love John Wayne in all of his old movies, but if you look at the characters in the John Wayne movies, especially in the 30s, when before he was really well known, before he did Stagecoach, and then and really even the movie Stagecoach, I love that movie, but it's a collection of cartoonish characters. almost none of which are realistic to the West. It's cartoonish, racial stereotypes. It's just entirely unrealistic. There's just no way. If you think, you know, people really don't change that much. If you think of people in, you know, 2000 BC, people in 100 BC, people in 1000 AD, people in 1940, and people today in 2012, there may be a social variances and there may be cultural oddities that manifest themselves from time to time, but really and truly, people don't change that much. When you see these exaggerated characters in Hollywood movies, look around your own life and ask yourself how many people like that you really know, that you really know of in your everyday life, and you don't know of any. Think of the people. Let's just take I believe it was Andy Devine that did the Stagecoach Driver in the movie Stagecoach. A way over-the-top, exaggerated character actor that was used in a lot of movies that intentionally portrayed a somewhat comical view of what this person was. Also, if you think of the movie Stagecoach, and you think of the Mexican, the guy that ran the outpost, the Stagecoach outpost way out in the middle of the desert, was a Mexican man with an Indian wife. And you think about the way that they almost cartoonishly portrayed the Mexican character in there. And then if you know anybody who's of Hispanic descent, ask yourself, do you know any Mexicans like that at all? Do you know anyone of Hispanic descent in any way that is even remotely similar to that cartoonish character? And then you just take that point by point through the characters in this great movie, Stagecoach. Think of the banker. Think of the evil banker that's in that movie. Now, sure, there have been lots and lots of bankers who have, used immoral practices to steal from their banks. But you really look at that character in that movie, and he's absolutely a cartoonish caricature of a real banker. He's not even remotely similar to a real human being. But like every other character in that movie, that's how they're portrayed. If anything, the John Wayne character is the least cartoonish in the movie. And that's probably what the appeal there always was with John Wayne, that he, even though he is almost a manufactured stereotype of what we envision the old Western hero to be, he's a lot less cartoonish than most of those character actors like that. And I think that's why he stood out and was as successful as he was. Now, getting back to this thing with the with history being a series of lies, even comparing, you know, I was talking about how movies changed to a certain extent from the 20s and 30s. Really, the Westerns were aimed at young children. And up into the 40s, late 30s and early 40s, they started adjusting themselves, and there were Westerns who were the Western movies that were more pointed towards young adults, because it was really that same audience that they had as Western fans of Western movies that had now grown up and were in their early 20s. And specifically, after World War II, Westerns changed pretty dramatically, and they took on this strong status tilt after World War II. And then back around the late 40s, right after World War II, you had sort of a separation in Western movies. You had these more John Wayne-ish hero, I can't remember the guy's name that was in High Noon. These very much more adult-oriented Western movies. And then you had these very silly, cartoonish-type Western movies with people like Hopalong Cassidy and Can't remember the other guy with his horse Trigger. Anyway, and these were really more towards pure entertainment for kids. They were obvious good guys, obvious bad guys. The good guys ride in, save the day, and totally unrealistic scenarios. But for a kid, just a ton of fun to watch, you know. And I enjoy those silly things like that. It's no different, really, than watching the Marx Brothers or watching the Three Stooges. You don't watch the Three Stooges try to, you know, when they're ripping apart a mansion, trying to put in new plumbing, you don't actually imagine plumbers working that way. You realize that what you're watching is a complete cartoonish nonsense. And that's the way with these childish westerns. You don't actually watch them thinking that you're looking at history. But as we absorb those, and since there's nothing provided to counter that, those end up getting stuck in your head as aspects of real history. And of course, the state plays up on this. The state school textbooks are all twisted in those directions that best suit the state. There's no surprise there. You know, I could do a whole podcast on just how horribly school textbooks lie and how they twist things in order to force kids to think in more ways, more and more to become dependent upon the state. Well, so, you know, it's not unusual that the state would then go in that direction of utilizing what's already being laid down by Hollywood in movies and what the dime novels from the late 1800s, what they have already glorified and laid down for entertainment purposes. It's not unusual to think that the state would then go and pick those up and use them to the state's advantage. You know, that's just the kind of a thing that the state does. So, I know what I was going to... I got off track there. I was going to compare the way... the Old West was pictured in the 1920s and 1930s with how it's pictured later on, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and then how it's portrayed more recently. I have a series of old books that were written by a guy named Stuart Edward White in the early 1900s. I think the first of the series was called California Gold, and it was written in 1910. And the copy I have is so old and delicate. I have a lot of old books like that. I've really wasted a lot of my time collecting old books. But the copy I have is so delicate that I almost don't dare touch it. It just sits in a box. It's not even out on my shelf. It just sits in a box waiting for a day that I have a good environment to display it in. But I did read it when I first got it. I went through and read it and was fascinated by it, and I've read it a couple times since then. But in this book, California Gold, Stuart Edward White gives the account of the California Gold Rush from 1849. Now, he wrote this in 1910. I think he wasn't born until like the 1870s or something like that. I don't know. I didn't think to look that up before I should have looked that up. It probably wouldn't have been that hard. I'm sure there's internet information on Stuart Edward White. But anyway, he was not yet born when the gold rush took place. But in 1910, when he wrote this book, California Gold, I think he sincerely attempted to portray it as accurately as possible and get away from the dime novel flashiness that was so common in the early 1900s. I think that was really his intent, because if you read, and I don't even know if the thing's still in print or not, but as I read through it, you could see that he was portraying real characters like you would know in real life. These were not the cartoonish characters that almost everything from that era was portraying from the West. And he also portrayed As the progression of the novel goes, you have these people in the on the East Coast that are leaving their families and everything that's stable to them in their lives, and they make their way to California in an attempt to cash in on the gold rush. And it follows this series of friends that that make their way to California, and then as they move from mining camp to mining camp, and their encounters with the locals and things like this. And you get a really good portrayal in it of how the mining camps worked in a stateless society. Because in 1849, in the eastern Sierras, and even in the western Sierras, in the western Sierras, you were a little closer to the influences of the state. But in the eastern Sierras, there was no indication of a state whatsoever. When you crossed over the peaks of the Sierras and you came into the eastern Sierras, you were in an absolutely stateless society. The state had no influence whatsoever in that area in the late 1840s. And that was much. That was also much the case in for most of California, along the coast and through the central valleys. You had the influence of the former Spanish, the very very Confederate, and by Confederate I don't mean South, you know, Southern United States and the Confederate flag and things like that. That's not what I'm talking about. But there was a sort of a Confederate confederacy of small statist outposts up and down California, mostly based around the mission system that was in that was along the coast of California. So, and as a lot of the immigrants came in to exploit the gold rush, very quickly the mission system failed them as a form of government, and a new state began to develop immediately, you know, because there were a lot of statists there. But so along the coast and along the central valleys, you did have a strong statist, very young, very immature statist system was being birthed. But when you get up into the Sierra Nevadas, that pretty much vanished. The state just could not have influence up there. Much like what I was talking about with James C. Scott's discussion of the hill people throughout the world. The state is always the weakest up in the mountains. So back to Edward Stuart White's book, in California Gold, you get to see how these little settlements were functioning in a stateless society and how well they settled what were sometimes, you know, very complicated issues about property rights and mining rights and wages and, you know, union organizing and things like this. Union organizing without the state, I might add. If you want to see, let's not go that direction. Okay, anyway, and then in addition to the book that I have, California Gold, I have two following in the series, Gray Dawn, and then the other is Rose Dawn. And I can't remember off the top of my head what years those came out, but I'm thinking they were both out before 1918 or. I'm pretty sure they were both out before the U.S. entry into World War I, because I don't see any influence at all from World War I in those novels. So I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure California Gold was published 1910. I think that's the date that I have on mine. And then the Gray Dawn and the Rose Dawn, I'm not sure the publishing dates on those. And like I say, they're very delicate, so I wouldn't even want to go mess with them or anything, but. But the point is, you get to see glimpses of California society in varying levels of no state to somewhat of a state to a little bit more of a state to then a more you know, progressive state that developed. And then you look at the rest of what was being fed to the American public about the Old West in the early 1920s and early 1930s, and you get a very, very, very different approach to that. I'm going to break real quick for the commercial here, and when I come back, I'm going to go back into this to a certain extent, but I want to talk about a couple articles at the Mises Institute as well. So I'll be right back in about 2 minutes. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug-out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do you do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page, and then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value, something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from BadQuaker.com. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And I do want to mention as well during the break here that BadQuaker.com, we at BadQuaker.com, are, if you haven't heard it in the last couple podcasts, we're sending 4 people to the Porcupine Freedom Festival in New Hampshire in a couple weeks. It's, believe it's June 18th through 24th, if memory serves correctly. I don't have that in front of me. That's going strictly by memory, so who knows if that's right or not. Anyway, if all goes well, I will be there with my motorhome, and I will be camping in, I have to look this up real quick, because I'm unprepared. We'll be camping in space number 82 at the Rogers Campground. And you'll see my motorhome there, as long as it's a civilized time of the day or night. Just knock on the door. If you happen to be there at the Porcupine Festival, knock on the motorhome door. Say hi to me. I'll probably actually be outside enjoying the wonderful New Hampshire weather. But be sure and stop by. If all goes well, Kai, my sometimes co-host, will be there. And a couple other people as well that we're bringing with us for the Pork Fest. So, that's my commercial for the New Hampshire Porcupine Liberty Festival for 2012. Getting back to what I was talking about there, I think I was starting to wander a little bit. So, I'll put links on the page at badquaker.com for the Mises article that I'm going to be referring to, and it's according to how I get wrapped up here in my talk, I might read from it a little bit. But there's actually 2 Mises articles that are very pertinent to what I'm talking about. One is called "The American West: A Heritage of Peace," and the other one there, and I'll provide links where this podcast appears on badquaker.com. The other one is called "The Not-So-Wild Wild West" by Terry Anderson. And Oh, I should have said, the first one I referenced, The American West, A Heritage of Peace, is by Ryan McMakin. And the other article is The Not So Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson. And they're both really good articles, and they're well worth the read. I'm not going to do them justice here. I really encourage you to read both of them. They're both really good articles, and they're both very important articles. But that's what I'm kind of talking about. That's what my inspiration for this particular podcast was in reading those articles. Now, I was talking about the book by Stuart Edward White called California Gold, and then his two follow-up books, Grey Dawn and Rose Dawn, from about the same time frame, early 1900s. And you compare that to something like what was given out in the movie High Noon, and I just lost that guy's name again that was in High Noon. Gary Cooper. In High Noon, you have these businessmen that were absolute cowards, and you have the one lone statist hero that has to save the day. Now, that's in every, that's kind of like a standard thing for a lot of Westerns. You have the cowardly business people and the one hero that has to ride in and save the day. And he's usually always like some kind of a statist. Now, not always. Sometimes he's the lone cowboy or whatever. But either way, this idea, this hero worship, this goes back. Kai and I on a couple of our podcasts, we talked about how this part of the myth of the state is based on a hero god, and you almost always have to have this hero god as a part of the myth of the state. And in America, our hero god generally is the president. That's who we portray as the guy who's going to save the day and fix everything. The last guy really, really was bad, but this new guy, he's going to really be able, or my guy, the guy I want to be president, he's going to fix everything. That other guy, that guy's no good at all. He's just the worst of all human beings, but my guy is a hero. He's great. He can't do wrong. And this kind of nonsense, this cartoonish portrayal of human beings only supports the state and cannot produce any real lasting difference in a positive way. That is, the deeper you believe the myth of the hero god in the state, the deeper you believe that, the worse the state gets and the worse things become. But to actually improve life and improve civilization, you have to reject that. And you have to realize that society is made up of billions of individuals all making decisions and all acting to a large extent, acting morally without the force and aggression of government hanging over our heads at all times. The other thing that a lot of these movies like to do is they like to have the cavalry come riding in and save the day. And in all actuality, just the opposite was true. If you look at the real events of the settling of the Old West in America, if you look at the real events prior to the war between the states, so we're talking from, let's just roughly say, 1800 to 1855 or so, 1855 or 1860, prior to the war between the states. You don't, around 1812, there was military problems, but there was, there was also state wars going on. But I was starting to say there was military problems with the Native Americans, and the battles with Tecumseh and Tippecanoe and these things. But what you really have there is not the settlers battling the Native Americans. You have the state expanding, literally the state with state armies, and a clash between the U.S. government and the government that was controlling Canada at the time, which was the British government. So you have a partial replay aspects of the American War of Independence. But mostly, if you most Americans don't know this. A lot of Canadians know what I'm about to say, but most Americans don't know that what actually started the War of 1812 were aspects of the United States government invading Canada. You know, there are a lot of excuses given about soldiers being pressed, or actually sailors being pressed into naval duty for the British government. That was a problem. That was definitely a an aspect of the War of 1812. But that had been going on continuously. That was a normal aspect of the British Navy for 100 years or more at that time. So in 1812, for the U.S. to suddenly go to war over that is totally illogical. And there were other issues as well. But the primary reason that the War of 1812 happened when it did and how it did was because the U.S. invaded Canada. And very few people in the United States know that. Like I said, a lot of Canadians understand that, though, oddly enough. But other than that little pocket of statist wars and so forth, most of the settling, most of the pioneers that moved westward, moving into first Missouri and you know, up into Minnesota and up in that area, and moving out into Texas, most of that was not the act of the state. Most of it was individuals migrating to get away from the influence of the state. And the great Mormon migrations out to Utah, that was entirely an attempt to escape the violence of the state. Now, there was a lot of social unrest with people who were uncomfortable, you know, hardline religious people who really hated the Mormons because they wouldn't conform to the much of the traditional, mostly Yankee religious ideologies that were prominent in the North. And I could go into Puritanism and how it turned into Yankeeism, and that's a whole nother podcast. But using the violence of the state, the former Puritan-thinking Yankees drove the Mormons westward. And I'm not a Mormon, so I'm not here to defend the Mormons or their actions or anything else. But if you look at it objectively, what you really had was religious fanatics who could not tolerate any variation from their accepted religious view. And so when the Mormons had something that was a bit radically different than what the normal, if we put parentheses, quote marks around normal, what the normal religious beliefs were of these Yankees, and then the Yankees used the violence of the government to drive the Mormons out of community after community, and they were eventually given no choice but to go westward and try to get away from the influence of the state. And in doing so, there were a couple of violent incidences once the Mormons got to Utah, but to a large extent, the Mormon settlements in Utah were entirely peaceful, and their cooperation with natives to a large extent was peaceful, and their cooperation with the existing Mexican culture that was in the Southwest was largely peaceful and was based on commerce, not on aggression and not on conquest. And you see this all the time prior to the war between the states. The lot of what we now refer to as mountain men, a lot of trappers and hunters moved into the central mountain ranges, the Tetons and the Rockies, and even to a lesser extent into the Sierras, and well up into Canada. And these were largely peaceful people who cooperated all the way down into Mexico as well. But these were largely peaceful pioneers and settlers and mountain men who moved in and cooperated with the locals that were already there. And to a large degree, you don't see the kinds of problems with the native, the clashes between the Native Americans and the pioneer Americans. You don't see those prior to the war between the states. But then, during the war between the states, how do you put this politely? There's no way to put this politely. You have people like Lincoln, who was a horrible racist. Lincoln hated the Native Americans almost as much as he hated the African Americans living in the U.S. And Lincoln almost immediately began the extermination of Native Americans. He, if you consider the hatred of Lincoln, the hatred of men like Sheridan, and, you know, Sherman is a really interesting character. If you do very much research on William Tecumseh Sherman, what you find is a deeply evil man. I wonder, you know, his hatred for Native Americans was just amazing, the depth of hate that the man had towards the Indians. And I wonder if it was because he was actually named after and possibly a descendant from one of the great Indian heroes and leaders, Tecumseh. Tecumseh, you know, William Tecumseh Sherman, being from Ohio, you have to understand something about Ohio. After the War of 1812 and the death of Tecumseh, he became such a legend that a lot of white people living in Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Indiana suddenly found out, oh, lo and behold, that one, you know, Indian girl that great-grandpa Larry married, she was one of Tecumseh's daughters. And that myth has saturated lots of families in Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Indiana. If you consider how many families that can trace their roots back to the early 1800s in Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, and West Virginia, if you consider how many of those families claim to have some member of their family being a daughter of Tecumseh, Tecumseh would have had to have had thousands of female daughters. So this is a myth that got carried on pretty frequently in the early 1800s, that somebody, you know, someone's a member of their family was related to Tecumseh. And I can't help but to wonder, I have no evidence of this, but I can't help but to wonder if William Tecumseh Sherman didn't have a hatred, if his hatred towards Native Americans was based squarely on the fact that he was named after one of the greatest heroes of the woodland Indians. I can't help but to wonder if that's the case. But whether that is the case or not, the man had an illogical and just a bizarre hatred toward Indians. And as soon as he had the slightest indication of power, he began sending troops to exterminate them. And I might add, if time would allow, I could go into how someone like Custer became a political threat to people like Sheridan and Sherman and Grant. Grant was another man that was so full of hate that it just dripped from him like molasses everywhere he walked. But if you consider how much they hated the Indians, and then if you consider the political threat that somebody like Custer presented to them, then you understand why it was a win-win proposition to send Custer out to attack people who were relatively peaceful at the time and were more than willing to continue to be peaceful. And then you march American troops in on them to raid their villages and attack them brutally. And then you're surprised because you have an Indian war. You know, the Custer, no matter how you look at this situation, Custer was used as a hammer against the Indians, and when Custer became less useful, his owners simply put him into a position where they knew he would die. I'm thinking of, for the biblical scholars out there, I'm thinking of David sending, Uriah up to the wall to fight up too close to the wall. And Uriah, being the faithful servant that he was, marched right up there and took the slings and arrows and died for David's ego. And that's pretty much what happened with Custer. Custer became a threat to the established Republicans that were in control of the White House and in control of the military-industrial complex of the day. And so Custer was killed. Custer was killed because he was so stupid and so egotistical that he not only followed orders, but in his own self-glorification, he thought he could do the impossible. And so he got what he deserved. But I have really strayed from my point of what I wanted to get to, and that was the anarchical society that existed especially in the early 1800s, prior to the war between the states, throughout the West. The Mexican government was far too weak to provide any kind of true status society throughout the American West. And from the time of the Louisiana Purchase until the war between the states, the American government was far too weak to really bring the influences of the state into the American West. So you have a completely stateless society existing from about the Sierra Nevada mountains all the way, excluding Texas to a certain extent, all the way to the Mississippi. Almost all the way to the Mississippi. You have a relatively stateless society, or in some cases completely stateless society. And then the myths that have developed, and this Mises article goes into a lot of these, the myths that were developed for the purpose of selling dime novels, telling all the violence of cities like of towns on the prairie and on the plains, like Abilene and Dodge City and things, where almost all of the violence portrayed was entirely made up for the purpose of selling dime novels. Even to the point of where, if you consider like Buffalo Bill Cody and all the great exploits that he bragged about and made a living off of, and in his old age. Now, a lot of people during his lifetime had attempted to debunk his lies, but he was so flamboyant and he was so so masterful at spinning his lies that it was far, and plus it was far more convenient to believe the lies that that Buffalo Bill Cody was spreading, because you know, people like to hear fantastic stories. Nobody likes to hear a story about, well, you know, there was this settler and he was in the northern parts of Colorado, and there were 8 or 10 other settlers that were just within a few miles of him, and he trapped and he farmed and he traded, and what a wonderful life he had. Now, who wants to read that? Who wants to see that portrayed in a show? Who wants to watch a movie like that? That's just, if you consider the Little House on the Prairie stories, even as much as they try to make those entertaining, they don't really have the impact of, say, Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show, where, you know, people are shooting guns and riding around in circles and shooting at wagon trains and so forth. It doesn't have that kind of an appeal, because it's more of a very realistic story of people just living their life and going through the normal things that a person goes through when they live their life. And so, you know, that doesn't have the kind of appeal that Buffalo Bill Cody had. One of the things that Buffalo Bill Cody claimed was that he had been injured 137 times in battle with Indians. Well, it turns out maybe he was injured once in an actual conflict with Indians. Maybe. But, you know, but people didn't want to believe that he may have been injured once. They wanted to believe his story of 137 injuries. Now, I was talking there about the war between the states. Everything pretty much changed in about 1870 when there was, Lincoln had sent some, had made some aggressive moves towards the natives during his presidency. But around 1870, there became a concentrated effort to exterminate the Native Americans. And, you know, people on the right tend to want to look over this. They want to close their eyes. People on the left want to use it to beat up Americanism. But if you look at it honestly and you take off the tilted glasses of the left and the blinders of the right, and you really look at what was going on, you have a state that needed to take over an area that was stateless. And you have hardcore statists who were willing to exterminate an entire people in order to move the state into that area. And that's exactly what the Indian Wars were. They were entirely lopsided in one direction. The Indians were in a defensive stage. They were attempting to withdraw as much as possible. They attempted to get along as much as possible. And the United States government routinely met their attempts at peace with brutal, harsh violence and slaughter. And I'm not putting up revisionist history for the purpose of bashing America, because it wasn't America that was doing this. It wasn't the pioneers that were doing this. It wasn't the settlers. It wasn't the businessmen. It wasn't those people that were doing this. It was strictly coming out of orders from the United States government by the hands of the United States military, who had been hardened to this kind of stuff during the war between the states. It would have been very difficult to get regular American troops in the 1830s to commit the kind of atrocities that took place in the 1870s and 1880s. It would have been really hard to get American troops to do that, to just go through and just murder Indians, killing women and children with their boots and rather than wasting, you know, bullets on them. That would have been really hard to get American troops to do that in 1830, because they were not the hardened, seasoned killers that had been produced from this really, really tragic and unnecessary war between the states. And I might add, let me see how my time is. Yeah, I can add this disclaimer just so that there's no confusion. I would assume my readers know this already. But the war between the states was entirely unnecessary and had nothing to do with slavery. Slavery was gotten rid of over and over in different places without a giant war and murder and everything. And if you're offended that I said war between the states instead of calling it a civil war, it was no more a civil war than calling the moon the sun would be accurate. It was not a civil war. The Southern Confederacy never, ever, ever attempted to take over the North, never attempted to take over the government of the North. It was not a civil war in any possible way that you could describe a civil war. It was an attempt at the exact same thing that the War of Independence was. It was an attempt at independence from one body from another. And the South had every right to make, if you believe that the colonies had a right to independence, then you can't logically and honestly believe that the South didn't have a right to independence, or that the individual even today has the right to independence. So it had nothing to do with slavery. Read Lincoln's first inaugural address if you're not sure about this. Lincoln made it clear that he had no intention whatsoever of making slavery an issue. And he was perfectly comfortable keeping the slaves in every way just like they were. The only thing Lincoln cared about, the one issue Lincoln cared about, was slapping the South with a massive tax that was absolutely intolerable and that they could not bear the burden of. And that was the motivation for the war between the states. So I just wanted to throw that disclaimer out. If somebody doubts that, drop me an email. I have way more information on that than any sane person would ever want to read. So it's all right there waiting for that opportunity to share that. Well, I do need to wrap it up about now. I think we're getting pretty close to our time on that. I didn't really get to the points that I wanted to make about the anarchical societies of the Old West. But please go over to badquaker.com, get to the link that's on this page for the Mises Daily article that's there, and also that PDF, the link to the PDF on The Not So Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson. And it's worth a read on both those two articles. They're wonderful articles, and they're well worth your time to read them. Okay, so once again, if you're going to be at Pork Fest, drop by site number 82 and tell me hi. I'll be around there, you know, hanging around, eating hot dogs and stuff like everybody else. So be sure and stop by and say hi. And for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening to my